Browsing in the charity shop of an English South Coast town quite recently, I heard a teenager ask at the counter if there were any typewriters for sale. He was out of luck that day, but as he left, I asked this hip-looking youngster why he was interested in a redundant technology. From the pocket of his hoodie, he produced a writing pad, and flicking through the pages of inky notes to show me, he explained that he was a writer, and just liked the idea of experimenting with the old way. He wanted to explore what typing felt like. He's not alone. Amongst the iPod generation, there are increasing numbers who are discovering the joys of eking out a ragged ribbon, anything rather than change it with the mess that implies, and easing the paper in with a familiar grind of gears, experiencing the lost choreography of enthusiastic carriage return and the drama of tearing pages out of a machine which has no on-off switch. Like many 40-something journalists and office workers, I was weaned on Remingtons, Royals and Coronas, not cigarette brands, but the mighty, weighty typewriter kings, on slippery leaves of carbon paper and the crescendo of frantic X-ings out. If it all went horribly wrong, my Tippex corrections leadened the page like a sculptural installation, but were still easier to me than the quick-fire electric golf ball machines which spattered out type with a life of their own. There was and is something visceral about real typing. Not the soft touch of a laptop, but the whole body involvement of hammering the words into shape. Ideas form differently when the words are on the page, peppered with typos, and when the story can be ripped out or scrunched into a ball and hurled at the bin. Writing this memory now feels like connecting with times long past, but some people have never left the typewriter age behind. Like those who still use their first computer, the association of message and medium is maybe too strong to risk updating. The American author Paul Auster still famously uses his manual machine and pays homage to it in The Story of My Typewriter. The illustrations have even been displayed as artworks in a Boston gallery. I'm an archaeologist as well as a journalist, and I've seen some pretty powerful artifacts in my time. But one of the most effective I ever saw anywhere was Jack Kerouac's never-ending, literally it was one roll of paper, 1950s typescript for On the Road. Displayed in a museum in Rome, it had all the emotional pull of a medieval manuscript. It practically yelled out Kerouac's urgency to get the words down, his experience conveyed, the paper yielding under the powerful pounding of type onto the page. If I visit a writer's home or literary museum, it's the typewriter in the study, more than the pen laid on the desk, which engages me. Something to do with the mechanics of this simple technology, the energy required to drive the keys, and the dust gathering as gently as the writing process is dynamic. Coffee spilt over the keys? No problem. It adds to the history. The machine will still work. But something tells me that drink-spattered computer keyboards won't have the same resonance or the same longevity. This typewriter appreciation, more than a nod to aesthetics, is as much about the way we created or communicated in the days when computers were machines that filled whole rooms and we had to book our time on them. And even then, our interaction was mediated by a programmer who knew the secret codes. Typewriters and computers coexisted. When the digital switchover got underway in earnest, it quickly became less about cutting edge and more about cutting teeth. The problems were the start of a technology blame game. It was all the computer's fault. Our relationship with new technology was becoming a difficult one, and in many ways, those of us who remember the dawn of the everyday computer age have yet to kiss and make up. We hark back to that more sensory time of ink-stained fingers, news stories filed to Fleet Street copy takers from remote coin-fed phone boxes, of darkrooms populated by photographers who delighted in the chemistry of their craft. Change was overnight in many cases, as dramatic as from the darkroom into the newsroom's artificial light. The photographer was now at a desk with a PC, just like any journalist, and his whole perception of photography, the speed, the edit, the reproduction, was now down to software and not to something more obviously tangible or fixable. I know of photographers who quit their jobs at this point. Others who, after battling the unassailable accelerating technological change, converted to digital and were won over. A friend of mine, the photographer Harold Chapman, who worked for the New York Times in the 1950s, had lived at the Beat Hotel in Paris, capturing William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg and others of that circle in stark black and white. He could be forgiven for being negative about photography's evolution out of alchemy and into a new form of photo manipulation. But while Harold leaves me rapt with his tales of a darkroom made out of hotel bedsheets in the tiny attic at No. 9, Rue Jules de Coeur, he's been the one to advise me on buying my first digital camera. And while Harold's 50-year-old prints are being remade from original negatives, scans of them are hurtling around in cyberspace, attachments he's sent. Darkroomless but liberated by his digital cameras and computer, Harold, now in his 80s, is busier than ever. Having a handle on both the old and the new usually comes out of watching change happen, seeing how the big and beautiful machines have become ever smaller and more packed with possibility, and more complicated. But what's interesting is the appreciation of retro technology by those who've never seen it as anything but history. They look on my former work tools with a degree of nostalgia for times not really remembered. In Silicon Valley, California's heartland of tech development, the Apple store sits in Palo Alto, just down the road from the motherlode, Apple HQ in Cupertino. It's a pale, high-end shrine, with products displayed like objects in a gallery. Settled into their low chairs, Palo Alto's podween children spend their Saturdays displaying a digital mastery which leaves their parents pulling for the door. To these youngsters, the models from the 80s and 90s, the Apple I and the Apple Classic, the LC3, the Newton, remember that early digital notebook? And the bubblegum-coloured iMac, are genuine artefacts of history. Show them a vintage Byte magazine from the 70s and they'd probably ask if it really should be handled. A few years ago, I answered the Edge annual question set by New York science publisher John Brockman. The brief was a fantasy direct line to US President George Bush. I suggested the president might choose to give greater prominence to the role of history, or more precisely, prehistory, by reconsidering the significance of the simple stone tool and how it had changed over time. It was 2003, and I'd spent several years teaching American high school students about archaeology on a short summer program at Oxford. I used the simple device of asking them to think about the technology which had become redundant in their own short lifetimes. These objects were not traditional museum artifacts, so much as the old stuff cluttering garages, spare rooms, drawers and desks. They still held a kind of folk memory with which the students could connect through the archaic forms of cell phones or monitors on which their parents or older siblings had crafted documents, letters or spreadsheets. In the imagined email to President Bush, I made my argument. Without a sense of the past, there is a danger of raising a generation of change junkies, weaned on the rush of accelerating technologies, for whom history has no relevance. They would recognise technological change only through its material culture, the stuff, brought to them on the street and in a welter of media hits. In their world, where nothing stands still, they are left with no space to evaluate why technological change happened, and crucially, its implication. The challenge is to work with the materiality and mass consumerism of our everyday world, and to use it to communicate the scientific context in which technological leaps and bounds make sense. The tales which can now be told of these olden days, the early computer chaos predating reply-to-all email gaffes or social networking faux pas, bring into sharp relief how sophisticated we've become and how we're learning to cope with incremental change. In an apartment in Midtown Manhattan a couple of years ago, I waded through the extraordinary collection of stuff, around 100,000 objects, accumulated by a man in his 50s called Alex. Nearly all the artefacts were a form of communication or technology, in, to Alex's taste, its most aesthetically pleasing forms. Alex knew what he liked, but couldn't specifically say why he liked it. But he had three organising principles: wonderful, wacky, and wow. He collects what he calls blue-collar art, reflecting every segment of everyday life as it filtered down from the high-end stores. From radios in the shape of food items to journeyman-made products hawked by travelling salesmen from door to door, model houses, name signs, containers for everything from milk to the post. Each had an authenticity in which the process of making is apparent. We can engage with the vision which created the object. So, what can we say about the vogue for retro tech, which isn't steered by nostalgia, but by style? In many ways, the fashion for this vintage comes from those who didn't experience it the first time round, but can still give a knowing nod. The innovation-led city of Seattle, home of Microsoft, has a large number of retro tech stores in which hefty monitors and adding machines with, get this, paper, have joined the more knowingly sought-after Bakelite phones in the window. The store owners get their stock from charity shops and eBay, but they're presenting something old as something new, in a way more intriguing than any antique dealer. Of course, there are websites on which you can buy retro mobile phones, those bricks we hauled around when they were cutting edge. Japanese youngsters are especially keen on them, and also on using a small mobile, but with an old-fashioned handset, complete with a curly cable. You can have your computer supplied with a wooden fascia for that early TV cachet, and some techies are running their fast new machines inside the shells of 1970s PCs. On the continent, I've visited bars and hotels which display their retro chic savvy by installing 1980s Pong and breakout machines, or banks of green type on black screens. The vintage computer festival Europa, spawned by the Silicon Valley original and now held in Munich each year, attracts increasing numbers of students, drawn, they tell me, to the surprising colour, range and shapes of the early PCs. Last year, I joined the throngs at Burning Man, the alternative art festival which began on a San Francisco beach in the 1980s and now rises and falls each year in remote Nevada as Black Rock City, urban ephemera which has the coda Leave No Trace. This city should be twinned with Brigadoon and have Mad Max as mayor. Its artists haunt scrap dealers for the residues of cubicles and laboratories, converting the bright white playa or desert floor into a dystopian gallery. By night, people, works and vehicles, steam-driven bicycles, bus-sized shopping carts, fire-wielding ferries, blaze, shimmer and pulsate against the vast black sky. The neat twist to this is that many of the artists are also Silicon Valley techies, for whom Burning Man is a 21st century cabinet of curiosities. Inspired by this experience to make something for the Californian Vintage Computer Festival, I gathered materials from Silicon Valley surplus stores, connectors wrapped on vast spools like Victorian embroidered ribbon, bundles of knotted coiled cables, and lengths of oscillating lights. I contrived something around a 1970s IBM machine running an early computer game, a fantasy which didn't last long before the aging monitor blew. We can look at retro tech, handle it, and remember the great expectations we had for it. Think of it as both history and modern design, and, in my lifetime at least, appreciate the typewriter as well as the lightweight laptop. We can engage with the stories of how the machines were developed, because the accelerating technology means even today's mass-produced computers elicit fresh tales. Think of upgraded mobile phones, now often passed down in the family to the less tech-savvy members, before even they demand more functions. How much can we now read our family histories in our hoards of titanium, chip and plastic?